Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Everything Iconic with me, Danny Pellegrino. It's a holiday weekend, but I have a very special episode for you guys. We have an interview with Gail from Top Chef. I can't wait for you guys to hear it. Top Chef, the new season, just started last week, and I interviewed Gail before the season kicked off, and I'm going to play that for you guys in just a minute. But before we get into that, I have a very special guest. I have my legal counsel here, which is really my roommate from Ohio University, Bryant Greening. Bryant, how are you doing today?
Danny, I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm so excited to see you. And I got to be honest, I have so many questions about this Jen Shah case. It's been really intense and everyone's been asking. We did a whole episode breaking down sort of the beginnings of it, but there's been a lot of stuff happening ever since. So I want to get into that with you. But before I do have to mention one thing. Now, a lot of people, they sort of associate me with Jessica Simpson. And one of the things I always have to remind people is that I actually lived with someone in college, a straight guy, who had a Jessica Simpson poster in our dorm room. And it was you, Bryant. You had the Rolling Stone Jessica Simpson cover in our room sophomore year. And I'll never forget that.
I will take all the credit for your Jessica posts, for everything that you've become because of Jessica Simpson right here.
Oh, I love it. I sometimes see pictures back from our dorm room, which was just a complete gross cesspool. But there was a Jessica Rolling Stone cover hanging. And honestly,
Housewife of the Year, I think it was.
Right. I love that. Bryant, so this case has been really a lot. Now, this last week, she pled not guilty to the charges. Are you familiar with what the charges are? Because I tried to explain and I don't think I really fully understood. So can you explain to people maybe like how can we understand it?
Sure. So she's been charged with two counts. One is conspiracy to commit wire fraud, and the other is conspiracy to commit money laundering. So we have to start with, what is wire fraud? Wire fraud is when someone engages in a scheme to defraud others using false representations. And then in making those false statements, uses what we call interstate wire communication. Now, that's a big term, but that can be a bank transaction across state lines. It could be an email. So just the act of defrauding somebody over a wire, over a line, can be a federal charge. And that's what she's got, what she's facing here. And then money laundering, it sounds super complicated. We hear about money laundering and, you know, many, whether it's Walter White or whatever, it's basically just conducting a financial transaction, knowing that the money involved was the proceeds of an illegal activity. So she made money illegally, and then she committed a financial transaction with that cash.
And is this a common thing? Like, how often does this kind of situation happen?
All the time. Federal prosecutors are bringing money laundering charges and wire fraud charges every single day. And sometimes there's more defendants, sometimes there's less. Here it seems like Jen was part of a bigger conspiracy.
And I should mention, you're an attorney too, so that's why you're our expert here at the legal counsel. I don't know if I mentioned that before. Do you think these charges were brought upon because she's in the public eye, or do you think these would have happened regardless?
They should have been filed regardless of whether she's in the public eye. The bottom line is, she is charged with very serious offenses of defrauding people out of money, tricking people into giving her money. And if the allegations are true, she's going to pay the price.
Okay, now it was reported that she was allowed to post a $1 million recognizance bond. I don't even know what that means. What does that mean?
So basically, a bond is where she's allowed to be out of prison during the initial stages of the case. So she's going to eventually either plead guilty and accept a plea deal, or she's going to go to trial. And until that finality, until we know exactly what's going to happen here, she's allowed to be out in public with certain conditions. You asked about the $1 million. So the judge is saying you need to fork up $1 million and make that available to the court so that if you run, if you aren't available to face these charges, we're going to keep that money. And it's an assurance that she's going to show up and be a participant in the process.
Now, she's on a reality show. Do you think it's smart to be continuing filming? I think it was reported that she can continue working in that capacity. Would you recommend it?
If she was my client, I would be telling her to be as quiet as she possibly can be and to let the lawyers handle the case. Now, certainly there are defendants who have won cases in the media. They've made such a splash and colored so many different minds that, you know, they win on non-legal arguments. You could see, if you remember the old Illinois Governor Blagojevich, he tried to do that. He went on all the reality shows. He was on all the morning talk shows. That didn't work out so well for him, but it is a strategy.
So all of the free Jen stuff she's posting on Instagram is a strategy in some ways.
It's a strategy, but it's a stretch.
Right. Now, the trial is set for October 18th. Like, why? I don't understand. Maybe I'm just stupid, but like, why is there such a long lead time or lag time?
Well, in any criminal case, there's many steps to the process. Before you get to trial, the prosecutors need to hand over all the evidence that they have against the defendant. The defendant and his or her attorneys are able to talk to witnesses, try to develop a defense. The discovery process in and of itself, which is the passing over of evidence, can take some time. A trial date, you know, 7 months out is actually not that long.
Okay. Now, is there anything else you would like to point out about this that sticks out to you?
Well, I think we get a lot of questions about this initial not guilty plea. People think, oh, she's taking a stand. She's defending herself. That may be what she ends up sticking with. She may plead not guilty the entire time and take this case to trial and see what a jury decides. But I can tell you that most defendants at the initial stages of a case are entering a not guilty plea. They'll see the evidence that's against them, and then their lawyers will develop a strategy as to whether, oh boy, they got us, we better be looking to make a deal, or, you know, there's some holes here, and we think that we could sit in front of a jury and put on a good case.
Well, Brian, I'm so glad you stopped by. Is there anything else we should know about this Jen Shah case?
Just keep a close eye on it. I think that the next couple weeks are going to be telling, because that's really when her defense attorneys are going to have their ability to sink in and dive in to all the evidence and really develop a strategy. And if she's going to make a change in plea, you could see that in the coming weeks or months.
Oh, so there will still be updates before October, whatever.
Absolutely. So she can change her plea pretty much at any time. And the prosecutors are going to be asking her whether that's on the table, whether now that she's seen the evidence that they've gathered, has had the chance to sift through all those documents, if she wants to try to work towards cooperation points rather than fight this tooth and nail all the way to the end and not get the benefit of cooperating early on.
You know, I'm sort of fascinated by the fact that her husband is seemingly not involved. And I think to myself, like, does he know? He must know. Do you think he could know about all this stuff if it was true, if she is guilty?
It's possible. Some people are very good at concealing their crimes and some people work in tandem. And I can't speculate specifically in this case, but I can tell you that there is the opportunity to have a superseding indictment. Meaning if there are other people who are guilty here or who had knowledge of what was going on, they could later be brought into the case.
Wow. Brian, I appreciate this. This was so helpful because I don't understand all the legal jargon. I'm an idiot. And, you know, it really is helpful. Brian, thanks so much. I love you, buddy. Thank you for taking the time.
All right, Danny. Talk to you soon.
Okay. All right.
Bye.
This episode of Everything Iconic is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues.
your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. Now, I'm not sure if you've noticed, but it's definitely allergy season. You all know I've been struggling a little bit. I usually love the springtime, but I struggle with my allergies, which are just not the most fun. But luckily with Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, the only tissues I like to use, I can say, bring on the blooms, and I can face those allergies head on. Now, Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved, so you can attack watery eyes and battle runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. That's why I love these, because they're so incredibly soft, and I don't want to touch my nose with something that's not. Now, I am obsessed with Kleenex. I think they are so really just the best to do it. So for this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on. Again, this allergy season, do not pick up something else. Grab Kleenex and face allergies head on. I'm here with Gail from Top Chef. I am so excited. Gail, first of all, how are you doing today?
Thanks for asking. Hi, Danny. I'm excited to be here too. I'm doing okay. You know what? We're feeling hopeful today. It's way colder in New York than it should be on this day, but ultimately I feel like there's some light coming through the clouds, you know? Right.
I'm here in LA and I have my jacket on because it's really cold here today too.
See that. And
unexpectedly. Gail, I gotta say, I started watching Top Chef at the beginning of quarantine with my boyfriend, and we binged through 11 seasons plus the 2 seasons of Just Desserts. And then we had to take a break. Yeah. We had to take a break because we were like, this is a lot. But we're excited now for the new season to watch like in real time. Have you heard from other people who have sort of binged over this kind of crazy period we've been living through?
Like a lot, you know, everything kind of happens all at once for amazing reasons. And, you know, the sad part of quarantine, obviously, this, I mean, there's so many sad things, but the pandemic, obviously, with lockdown, shut down the restaurant industry, which was horribly depressing and catastrophic, truly. But one amazing small point of light was that our previous season, our All-Star season, season 17, premiered the week after lockdown began in mid-March last year. And I think it did instill some life and escape and hope for our industry, but also just for people at home who were looking to see, you know, kind of goodness and hopefulness and talent do what they do best on the show. So season 17 was really momentous for us in a lot of ways. It was a really exciting season, but I think it, just the timing of it was really fortuitous that it installed like much needed hope and enthusiasm into the industry and about the show. And because of it, people then, when the season was over, really started binging the show again. And that was really exciting. Although I always feel terrible for anyone who goes back to season one and has to deal with my hair and like, you know, the fashion choices that we all made back then. That's like a whole other podcast.
Right.
But you know, it was amazing that all of a sudden it stirred up everyone's reinvigoration of the show, and people were home so much that they started streaming. And then, you know, Peacock launched, NBC's streaming service that, you know, Bravo is part of. So people all of a sudden had so much more access to all the past seasons. And Just Desserts as part of it. Just Desserts is interesting because, you know, we just did 2 seasons, but I don't think a week goes by when I'm not asked about it.
No, and I'm
people
upset.
Are still so engaged with it. It was amazing. I mean, it's amazing. It's bizarre.
What happened?
And crazy.
Why aren't we getting another season? What happened? I like fell in love with Just Desserts.
Know,
I loved it.
Danny, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, that's a question for my Bravo executive, but I think a number of things about Just Desserts. We were ahead of our time in a lot of ways. You know, we shot it in like 2011, 2012, I think. It's all a bit foggy. But along, you know, it was like a decade ago, which is crazy. I was another person. You know, I was 17 at the time. Now I wish. But I think in terms of pastry and baking competition, we were sort of ahead of our time. And it was an enormously challenging show to produce, Nico, because pastry is so different in terms of just the process than cooking savory food, which can all just be done spontaneously, like, and finished within 45 minutes and you have a full 8-course meal and you see it come to life before your eyes. You know, baking is like you mix something and it looks like a blob and then you put it in the oven and it totally transforms, but you can't watch that transformation. And then it comes out and it needs 2 hours to cool. And then it needs, you know, there's so many steps and it's such a hard process, especially at the level that we wanted it at, because this is not an amateur competition. It has never been an amateur competition, you know, Top Chef for us. So I think after two seasons, there was just so many challenges from a production standpoint that they kind of put it on a pause. However, flash forward to now, and there have been so many amazing baking and pastry competitions come out since our show, some of which by the same production company, that are award winning, and they have overcome all those challenges that at the time we didn't have the technology to face. So I have been lobbying hard to bring it back.
Oh my God. I'll lobby right there with you.
Join me. Yes. We need to get a petition going. You know, there's so many other outlets for it now too. It doesn't have to necessarily be on Bravo proper, but now there is Peacock and there's all this original programming.
And by the way, there was also so much great drama, like aside from, you know, those seasons had really great drama, really great characters. Yes. And
chefs are a unique species and so different. I mean, we thought it was going to be the same thing as Top Chef, just baking, just like cakes and cookie version. And it took on a life of its own, like the characters and the crazy internal feelings of the kitchen. I mean, everything was different. And I think that's why it had its own very specific audience and cult following, like, and still does. So I'm grateful that you liked it.
Oh, I loved it. And you mentioned you're lobbying for it. Have you met with anyone in terms of bringing it back? Because I was actually going to ask you, I know there's been so many different Top Chef incarnations at this point. And I really do feel like it's something that could and should return. So have you had any actual conversations about it? Or
I have, you know, it's the same producers that I work with on Top Chef every year. They're like my second family. You know, we've been making this show for 18 seasons at this point, plus all the spinoffs. And every year I mention it in passing to my producers and my agents, and we kind of have a talk about it. I think they're just, you know, underwater trying to figure out everything at the moment. But you're inspiring me to get back on the honker.
Please.
And,
I loved it.
Get back to it.
What's more fun? Do you like sampling the desserts better, or do you like sampling what's better to eat?
Well, you know, it's interesting. People think that, like, first of all, I'm not a pastry chef, right? I'm a savory cook. I was trained in culinary. I'm not a chef, period. I do not run a kitchen. But I'm a savory cook and largely a savory person, but I definitely have a sweet tooth and a really true appreciation for the art of pastry, because it is so, so different than savory cooking. And they are just magicians. They are like wizards in the kitchen. The stuff that they do, the science and the creativity is so above and beyond my capabilities. From a tasting standpoint, the thing that I love about Top Chef is it's our meal. You know what I mean? Like, we can sit down every day, and when we shoot an episode, we know, like, it's usually lunch. And so I have a light breakfast, and then we get together and we have this big, like, family lunch, and that's the challenge, and that's Top Chef. And so I feel great at the end of it. And then we go to judges table and we do judges table, and then it's time for dinner and we all go out for dinner. Well, not in a pandemic, but usually. Right. The thing that I remember about doing desserts that was so sort of that caused me to really adjust was that I kind of assumed it was the same. Like, I wouldn't want to eat a big breakfast or anything because I knew I'd be tasting treats all day. But then I would get to the end of my day and realize, like, all I've eaten is 17 cupcakes today. And the sugar crash was so real. Like, I would be falling apart. Like, emotionally, I'd be like a puddle at the judge's table. My eyes would be rolling back in my head because I'd be like crashing from the sugar rush that I had been experiencing 2 hours before. Like, it was like a diabetic threat. Yeah. So I had to learn to actually eat meals before, like, really nutritious, healthy meals, because then I would, you know, if not, I would have the sugar crash, and then all I'd want is like a giant cheeseburger every day. And like, that doesn't make for a healthy lifestyle. So
if somebody were to ask you, like, what season is your favorite? I mean, you've done so many of them. Is there one you would tell people to kind of go back to and watch, or that you remember or sticks out in your head as being a favorite in terms of, like, the main Top Chef, whether it be All Stars or...
I mean, it's hard because they're also different. Like, the thing I love about Top Chef in general, which I really believe over our lifetime, you know, of making this show, which is at this point been 15 years of my life. I think that it has, you know, the uniqueness of it, the point that has differentiated it from so many other reality shows especially in our category, is that every season takes place somewhere new, you know, in a different city around the country, in a different country around the world. And it really plays into the content of the show, almost like a character in itself. And it really sets the foundation for the food we cook, the stories we're telling, and what we learn and what we taste, and like the ingredients, everything. So, and then there's the cast, and they are such an incredible bunch, and there's always such uniqueness to their stories too. So I always think back to the seasons, and I think my favorite like cast in terms of magic and energy and moment was season 6, which we did in Las Vegas, and then we went to Napa for the finale. And that was actually the season we won our Emmy for in Outstanding Competition Show. It was the season of the Voltaggio brothers and Kevin Gillespie and Jen Carroll and so many outstanding chefs. There was just like a magic to the chemistry of them. But when I think of my favorite season in terms of city to have visited or place that we went, I almost always go back to New Orleans, which was, I think, season 11. Because New Orleans.
Yeah, I mean, New Orleans food. Yeah.
The best.
Gail, I'm sure you've heard from so many celebrities. I know you guys have had celebrities on the show kind of come in and guest judge and things like that, because so many people are fans of the show. And actually, do you know Clea DuVall? She's an actress and she directed mm-hmm. Happiest Season. She was on the show in the fall, and she had mentioned you as being a crush of hers because she's a big Top Chef fan. And,
that's so cool.
And we were talking, it was like right during my binge. So we like talked about you for like a solid 20 minutes. I had to cut some of it out because it was like a lot of, we were just like gushing over you for a while, but she loves you. But who has surprised you? Is there anyone that's popped in your DMs or that you've met in person that you're like, oh my God, I can't believe.
So many people, like so, you know, random. I think Top Chef has sort of shown us that food is such a unifier. Like it doesn't matter where you come from, what you do. And in terms of celebrity, what's interesting is, and I hadn't thought about it until we started making the show, is that, you know, celebrities travel an enormous amount for the nature of their job. Musicians, actors, actresses, they are all, you know, they're all traveling for their work so much. They're spending such large chunks of their life in foreign cities. You know, they have to go to Berlin for a shoot, or they have to live in Atlanta for a year or whatever it is, or they're on tour. And so they're so vested in restaurants, and they just appreciate good food because otherwise there's like nothing to comfort them when they're away from home. So I'm always amazed that like they're all really dedicated foodies. And really are so excited to meet us and to get recommendations. Like, I mean, everyone from the Jonas Brothers to the Foo Fighters, you know, who've all been on the show and who have been so into food, which is really cool. You know, people like Nancy Pelosi. I mean, they're just, it runs the gamut. Politicians.
It was wild
like
watching
Charlize Theron, you know,
that DC season, that DC season where it was like, there's so many people in politics who were coming on the show, and it's been fascinating to watch. Yeah. Do you pre-write those critiques? I mean, cause I would imagine nothing's pre-written.
You can't, I mean, you don't know what you're going to get when you sit down at the table.
I wanted to play like a quick little game with you. I just have two things here. And I was wondering, like, how would you, obviously you can't taste this, but these are pretty common things. And I wondered, like, what would your critique, if you were doing something like a Reese peanut butter cup?
Oh, sure. I mean,
like, what would you say about it? Yeah.
I would say that the iconic combination truly has, you know, made it an important piece of culinary, you know, classic culinary combination in our universe. Like it is, you can't deny the beauty of chocolate and peanut butter, right? They work so well together. There's the saltiness of the peanut butter and the creaminess of the chocolate, and the you know, and the slight bitterness of the cocoa, which plays so well, you know, with the nuttiness of the peanut. I believe that a Reese's peanut butter is also incredibly versatile as an ingredient in other things. Temperature really matters for a Reese's peanut butter. You put it in the freezer, and it's a crunchy, cold, refreshing snack. You warm it just gently, and it becomes the most epic, ingredient in a s'mores. because that's good stuff when it's melty with a marshmallow and some graham crackers, or when you you know, if it's just warm and soft and gooey, like there's nothing more satisfying than that.
This is why you're so good at your job, Gail.
I don't know. I'm just
I do have one more. I don't know if you've seen this one. We'll just do one more, but this is the Lady Gaga Oreo, Chromatica Oreo.
Wait, no, show it to me. I haven't seen it.
Okay,
but I
it's
wow, that's is that two or is that one?
This is two. I have two.
They
have,
okay, cool.
They are allegedly the same flavoring as the vanilla Oreo, which is not the traditional Oreo. It's the vanilla with the cream.
Yeah.
But they are green centers and sort of a pinkish, orangish outside. It's the Lady Gaga Chromatica Oreo. How would you describe this to someone?
There's a lot of good to Lady Gaga and Oreo as a collaboration. I mean, two things that are really important to me personally, that kind of bridge the gap between childhood and coming into adulthood and, you know, what she stands for, which is like, you know, being openly who you are and being true to yourself and being a chameleon and exploring your identity, which I love about her. And these are clearly exploring the identity of an Oreo, you know, color wise. That's a lot of stuff right there. but you know what? Maybe that's part of it. Like, be bold, be bold, be you. I feel like that's a big message in Lady Gaga's arsenal. And I also think that like a vanilla Oreo flavor is, you know, great, classic and beautiful. You know, my concern in terms of ingesting it is just what the hell are the ingredients in there?
Right.
Probably just, you know, red dye number 40 or whatever it is. And, you know, in moderation, it's just fine.
What are the junk foods you eat in your everyday life? Like, there has to be some stuff that maybe culinary wise isn't great, but like that you just can't resist.
Oh, there's a lot, especially these days. We're comforting ourselves anyway we know how, Danny Pellegrino. You know, salt and vinegar chips are, I would say, like the kryptonite in my life. Like, I cannot turn down a salt and vinegar chip. It's just a beautiful thing. So that's the first thing that, like, if it's near me, I can't resist. I really like dark, dark chocolate, like the darker, the better. An 85% dark chocolate chunk is all I need at the end of the night. Like a little breaking off of a piece just completes the day, puts the period in the day, you know, full stop. I like black licorice. I'm a big black licorice.
Oh, wow.
I know it can be very polarizing. My father is South African. He grew up in South Africa that, you know, was colonized by the Dutch. And so there's a big Dutch influence. And so there's like black licorice comes into play, salty black licorice. And he really raised me to appreciate it. And I, in turn, have ensured that my daughter is not scared of black licorice because, P.S., although I love red licorice, that's not licorice. That's candy, and that's okay. What else?
What about fast food? Would you go through a fast food drive-thru line or no?
Well, full disclosure, no. Truthfully, like, I hadn't been in a fast food drive-thru line in probably 2 decades. Just had no need for it. During quarantine, you know, you indulge your children in any way you can because you just, number one, feel so badly for the whole damn thing. And also sometimes it's an emergency and you're in your car and you need your kids fed because they have to stop screaming or you're going to lose your mind. So during quarantine this year, we introduced our daughter to a McDonald's drive-thru. And, you know, as you can imagine, she thinks it's the greatest thing ever.
Yeah.
She really loves a Happy Meal, but it's not my choice.
Yeah.
Necessarily for myself, like I love an In-N-Out burger on the West Coast. I love Shake Shack on the East Coast. Like, I'm in that, you know, bougie, better for you kind of slightly fast food model. I try not to eat any of it too much.
I love
that doesn't mean I won't.
Shake Shack is my personal favorite. We have them both out here, and I personally love the Shake Shack. Okay, in Top Chef world, I've always been so fascinated by when the chefs create something. We do see footage of that dish. And then we see all of you eating a separate dish. And I always wondered, like, do they make separate dishes for production to film it? Or does production go and recreate it? Like, how does this work? And tell me that. I need to know.
This is a very astute question. And it's surprisingly one I don't get very often because you have to be paying attention. Like that's a question for someone who's paying attention. Yes, good question. We do not wait for food. We do not let it sit around. We eat it hot as soon as it's made. So when we say you have 2 hours, they have exactly 2 hours, and it doesn't matter if my dress isn't done up or Padma's makeup isn't on. Like we are at that table and we are ready for the food to eat it as fresh as can be. In the rules that you don't see behind the scenes is that when a challenge is explained to the contestants, you know, right when Padma says, what is the line that she says? it's Michelle. Like she'll, you know, and it's like, you'll have this many hours, you know, go. And we often stop down for a minute and the producers have to take the chefs through the legal rules of each challenge, particularly because there's a lot of questions and we want them to be loaded with all the information so that it's fair and clear what they have to do, the exact time that they get, the ingredients that they have. And they often like sign off on these rules to know that everyone's on the same page. Cause when there is miscommunication between production and the chefs, that could get really complicated. And so it is always told to them that let's say you're serving for eight or there'll be eight people at the table. You have to make eight dishes or you're making 200 dishes. They always have to make one more than you see of people eating them. So for example, this season, because of the pandemic, we have a judging panel of 12 past contestants, alumni who come back and they are on every episode with us as our diners so that we don't have to ever bring in guest judges because of the quarantine regulations. So they are bubbled with us and we all eat together every meal. So there's the 12 of them, more or less, and the three of us. So there's almost always 15 people eating on every episode in every elimination challenge. So when they are charged with their challenge, they always have to make 16 plates and they know that. So that when the timer goes off, 15 plates go to the table and one plate goes to a little section of our production called food porn, which is basically where the beauty shot goes. And there's a whole other team that takes that beauty shot and photographs it and shoots it. And that gets put into the episode.
Has there ever been a time where you think that maybe you have a different dish than someone else? Like maybe they plated it a little bit off or something? That happens
all the time.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's why there's four of us at the judge's table, because we want the full gamut of experience. And often if, you know, this is not a dictatorship, even though Tom may say otherwise, it's not a total democracy, but you know, there is a governing body of four of us so that there is room for discussion and experience. And often we find, you know, definitely people plate things differently. They have to cook for so many people and they have to make so many different duck breasts. And one duck breast might be overcooked while one is perfect and one is undercooked if they're not paying attention. So when they're serving it, I could get a very differently cooked piece of meat than Tom. And that's what we end up fighting out at the judges' table of the merits of how that matters, why that matters, and who made it best. What also we've seen happen a lot is, let's say, we use Restaurant Wars as an example in past seasons, although this season was very different for quarantine. Generally, over the years, we've split up for Restaurant Wars or for different challenges where we're going to different stations and like Padma and I will go to stations together and Tom and the guest judge or whatever the configuration is. And so we're eating at different stations at different times. And as the chefs are getting feedback from the different people who are tasting their dishes, they are adjusting as they go. So if I go at the very beginning of the challenge and taste something, it might not be as good as when the chef then has an hour until the other judges eat their food and they've made some adjustments and fixed some issues that they're having. So there can be those
discrepancies,
variants. And so again, that's why the four of us, there's always at least four of us or five of us at judges table so that we can talk it out. And like, you know, consistency is obviously key in a dining experience, but then it just becomes like the bigger picture and the merits of that dish and the technique and how to judge the, you know, what is more important in that moment or whatever.
This might sound like a stupid question, but is there one thing you won't eat or have you turned down a dish before?
It's not a stupid question. I get it a lot. No, I've never turned down a dish. Professionally, I couldn't do my job. Like, it's not about personal preference, even though there are definitely things that I like more than others. Like, we're all human. We all have our aversions and our, you know, our tastes, and we all feel differently about food, different food. But I know that my job is to be objective and to understand if it's cooked well, which isn't necessarily if I like it. Like, there's a big difference there. And so, no, I will never, ever turn down anything. I can appreciate all food if it isn't, even if it isn't to my exact taste. And that doesn't, but that's different than it not being seasoned properly or if it's being overcooked, right? I understand that the objectivity of technique versus my personal preference for something. There is definitely some food that I prefer not to eat or cook in my personal life because it's not my favorite. Like, I have this sort of irrational black bean aversion, which I've written about before. And, you know, I acknowledge that it's personal. I got very sick from black beans a long time ago, and it's hard for me to get over that.
Yeah.
But if someone serves black beans on the show, I'm not holding it against them because I once vomited when I was 25 because of a black bean dish and maybe some tequila. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's not their problem. And I can still appreciate the quality of their cooking technique and how they, you know, incorporated it into the dish. You know, Padma and I like our meat cooked to different doneness, but we both can appreciate, even though I like it more rare and she likes it more well done, when it's cooked properly, either way, right?
I want to ask you some questions that people wrote in at the Everything Iconic Patreon. Paola wants to know, what do you have a least favorite and favorite dish from all the seasons? Like, I mean, there's been so many things. I'm sure it's tough, but
yeah, favorite's really hard because every season we get so much amazing food, and every season I learn so much, and I'm like blown away at least twice an episode by a dish. Also, I don't have the brain capacity to remember 15 seasons, 5 spinoffs, 20 plates, an episode, 15 episodes a season. Like, the math is
just a lot.
Ridiculous. About, there's definitely dishes that have stood out in my mind. I mean, Paul Key, the winner of our Texas season, made a dish that I always go back to that was like a simple sunchoke and dashi soup with raw vegetables that was like so crazy simple and beautiful. I remember Kevin Spraga, who was the winner of our season 7 in DC. We went to Singapore. Actually, now I'm wondering if it was even him because it's all really foggy. It might've been one of the runners up on that season who made this like fried banana fritter with sriracha that at the time,
I remember, like, that, right?
Wow. That was so delicious. You know, there's countless, countless good things, but, least favorite, there's been a number of those too. But there's like a few that were almost inedible. There was an episode season 2, really early on, that the dish was like so salty, I could barely put it in my mouth. And then there was one time in Las Vegas, our season 6, when they were out cooking in the desert in like 112 degree weather and the shrimp went bad, cause it was like sitting in the sun, and it wasn't necessarily their fault. Luckily, Tom realized it when he started to put it in his mouth and stopped us all from eating it. So there's like definitely things like that where I was like, ooh, that could have been real bad.
Right. Catherine Phoebe Beach wants to know, where does the extra food go? Does the production step in if you guys don't finish a plate? Like, I'd imagine the camera people would just be like, okay, I'll finish it.
Pre-COVID was a different story. Nothing got wasted, like nothing ever. Yes, like anything we didn't finish, they may not be licking our specific plate, but yes, production, our camera guys, our culinary team would always eat leftovers for sure. And the contestants will eat their own leftovers. Obviously, this season was very different. We could not share plates amongst ourselves, let alone with anyone else. So the food on our plates was always put in the garbage for safety reasons, obviously. But there's also a lot of raw ingredients that don't get used. You know, they have to stock the pantry for anything that the chefs might dream up, but they only end up doing what they do. So there's always so many raw ingredients, dry ingredients, a pantry of food, and perishables that, you know, that beautiful bounty of fruits and vegetables in the kitchen that after 3 or 4 days need to be changed out to always look beautiful. And we never let that go to waste. And this year we were in Portland and we partnered with a food bank there and a church that had a soup kitchen and made sure that all of that food was delivered several times a week so that it was all being put to good use. A lot of hungry people out there.
The service industry has been hit so hard, like you mentioned, and I wonder what advice would you have for people who might want to help? I assume takeout and things like that. What can you tell people?
There's a lot. You know, this year has been so, as I said, catastrophic. Really, it's like the collapse of an industry, like watching watching your friends just fall apart, their businesses, their decades of work in minutes just shut down completely. And luckily, relief is on the way, at least partially. Like literally this week was momentous, a year to the day later, and arguably many months too late, but it's something and we're extremely excited about it. And that's thanks to the Independent Restaurant Coalition that really lobbied in Washington to get this act passed. So thank you, President Biden. But at the same time, and so it's overwhelming to think as a citizen what you can do. And yes, takeout is still really important locally. Takeout, delivery, try to use apps that are not taking the big fees off the top from them. So there's definitely apps if you can use or placing the order directly where the businesses see the money as, you know, maximized as possible. And then giving and donating if there's like relief funds for local restaurants. You know, in my neighborhood, I know a lot of restaurants have set up relief funds for their employees and also are selling merchandise, you know, hats, shirts, or are selling, you know, a bunch of the great little wine bars and cafes in my neighborhood have turned into provision places for provision. So that's where I'm buying my wine because they're selling it at wholesale prices. That's where I'm buying some pantry staples. And then just spreading the word. If you had a good takeout experience, tell your friends, post about it on social media, give them a great review. Like it all matters. And I know it's appreciated, whether it's $5 or $500. I just think that restaurants need our love and support and need to know that if they're going to go to all this work to rebuild, that we're going to be there on the other side.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
It's interesting you mentioned about the delivery apps, because I feel like most people don't do, they think it's so easy to just hop on that app, but it is important. If you could call the restaurant directly and you can either pick it up or get it delivered through them directly, it's really important.
Yeah. There's a couple really great apps. It's all still online. I know there's one called Toast and there's one called Chow Now, like that I know are really doing a great job of making sure that the minimal of charges or of fees, you know, are not going to the restaurant. So the restaurant are really managing it themselves and getting the most so that they're not losing money by doing takeout, you know.
Gail, I feel like I could talk to you forever and I don't want to keep you much longer. So I want to try to wrap this up, but this was such a delight for me. I'm so impressed by all of the work you've done. And I love you guys, like you and Padma and Tom, to me are the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit of Bravo. And I love my Bravo, but
I'll
like
take it.
After watching so many seasons, it's
lucky.
So good.
We feel good about the fact that like we truly love sitting down to dinner together and we get to do it a lot. And that, especially this year, has been like the greatest gift for all of us to be able to sit down at a table like we used to do and just talk about food and support the people we love, you know?
You've obviously had such a successful run on the show. Like what do you still dream about doing? Are there more books you want to write or what's like sort of next on your bucket list?
Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, where to start? I'm just like overwhelmed by getting through each day, but I will say one of them was realized this year on Top Chef that we haven't talked about that I'm really excited about for the future is that we made another show while we were out in Portland that will air later this year after Top Chef airs called Top Chef Amateurs. And it's the latest sort of spinoff of the show, but I think it is like Desserts, really unique and special, even more so in many ways because it's so, so personal. Top Chef Amateurs was born out of quarantine, really. We've never had an amateur level to our show, right? Top Chef, unlike any other show, is like 100% about professional restaurateurs and chefs at the highest, highest level. But this year in quarantine, everyone just became such incredible home cooks that you can't discount that and that experience and what home cooking means now. Like it's totally different than it was a year ago, right? People are like running bakeries out of their homes and recreating 17-course menus from their, it's like unbelievable. And so it was time to bring home cooks into the Top Chef fold. And we created Top Chef Amateurs to do that. It's about mega fans. I mean, truly mega fans who know the brand as well as I do, sometimes better. And we bring them into the Top Chef kitchen, and every episode is two different home cooks, really talented home cooks, who come into the Top Chef kitchen and really get like a day in the life of Top Chef. We put them through what it's like to walk into that kitchen, to do a challenge, to face off against a fierce competitor, and to stand at judges' table with us. And we're bringing back a lot of alumni to assist them, to judge them. So there's like a lot of, you know, all-star faces that come and make that experience really special. And remember that the people we shot with had literally not left their houses in 9 months, right? And they flew to us quarantined for a week to spend a day in the kitchen with us. So there's a lot of tears from me, from them, like tears of joy. And also just seeing what these chefs are capable of, you know, in the time we give them, and having never set foot in this crazy kitchen that's like really for professionals. They were amazing. And a lot of these people, there's like teachers and frontline workers, and like their stories are so cool. And I don't know, it's just, it was beautiful. So I can't wait for everyone to see it.
Gail, the last two questions I ask everyone, what's your favorite Mariah Carey song? And then also, if you were choosing for People Magazine Sexiest Man Alive, who would you choose?
God, those are good questions. One, Mariah Carey. I mean, that's a big anthology of work. I mean, the first one that comes to mind is like All I Want for Christmas Is You, because Love Actually. It's in my head all year round. Maybe that's low hanging fruit, but it's there. Although, what's the one that's in my head? Fantasy?
Fantasy is so good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I remember like the video was like amazing.
The roller coaster ODB remix was great.
Yeah, like just iconic, right?
Yeah.
So I'll take those. And then Sexiest Man Alive. Wait, who was the Sexiest Man Alive this year?
I think it was Michael B. Was it Michael B. Jordan? I think.
Yeah, it might have been, and he's up there for
he's
sure.
He's gorgeous.
Patrick Stewart is a weirdly, you know, iconic regal gentleman that I've always had an allegiance for. He's up there. And then I would say, oh my God, all the men. What a strange.
I love Patrick Stewart.
Question. I know that's a weird question. It's not that I want to see him with like his shirt off.
I get it. I love that.
He's just always been my guy. You know, because I'm a Star Trek nerd.
That's good. That's good.
I feel like there's obviously a lot others I can say, and I'm just, you know, overwhelmed and
it's
blushing
perfect.
At the thought of it.
It's perfect. Gail, is there anything else you want to leave people with? Anything else you want to promote before I let you go? Obviously, I saw the premiere and I thought it was excellent. It didn't. You guys went through so much to film it during the pandemic, but I thought it was just fantastic, and it didn't feel like we missed anything. It was wonderful. So I can't wait for the rest of the season.
Thank you. You know, I think this season's really honest. We address the pandemic. We address this moment in history for restaurants, for people at home, for people's experience, which can't be underestimated in all sense of the word. Like we try to face the problems of our time head on through the lens of food. And that includes everything from, you know, the pandemic to Black Lives Matter to, you know, like all of the most relevant things that are happening in conjunction with eating and how we experience, you know, how we make our eating choices. So I hope that everyone finds it as joyful as we felt making it.
Oh, good. Well, Gail, thank you so much for taking the time. This was truly such a pleasure for me. Take care, Danny, and be safe.
And I'll keep you posted about Top Chef desserts if I get any closer.
We're making it happen because I need it.
I might call on you to sign that petition. Yeah, yeah, yeah.